So my name sign was given to me by Wim Emmerich. I won't, you know, this is his name sign. He was a deaf dancer and he worked at the University of Amsterdam. And he was my first teacher of NGT, Sign Language of the Netherlands. And he recently died, and we miss him a lot. And perhaps this talk and all my achievements I can, you know, attribute to him, because he inspired me to go into the deaf community and study his language and their language, and you know, be their guest and their ally and advocate, I hope. So, sorry, we have to improvise a little bit because this ICT stuff's not working as we would like to, but bear with me. So here's our world. And I'm 6,000 kilometers away from home. But so far, I felt quite at home here. You know, people have been very welcoming and taken me up in their community. And I hope to be accepted by you in Philly, by the deaf community with you. Hope to visit you with lots of time. But, you know, 6,000 miles. But thank you for Skype and FaceTime, and because I can communicate with my family every day. And I'm very happy about that. So I'm going to tell you a little bit at first about the two communities that we have, the deaf communities in the Netherlands and in the USA. And I'll give you a minute to look at the sheet. Okay, so you see there's quite a big difference between our two countries. We have a very small, tiny deaf community. You have a very large community, but it's scattered, of course, across a very big country. We use Sign Language of the Netherlands, abbreviated to NGT, and that stands for Netherlands, well, sign. The Dutch word is gebaren. It starts with a G, so that's why the G comes from. And T stands for taal, T-A-A-L, and that's language, so it's Dutch sign language. But we don't like to use Dutch because the name of our spoken language is also Dutch, and that is confusing for hearing people. They hear Dutch sign language and they think, oh, it's a form of Dutch. And of course it's not, you know, it's just completely different language, but it's confusing as it is, so we don't use Dutch sign language, but sign language of the Netherlands. So furthermore, you know, the developments and the sources of deaf culture are more or less the same. They both began in special education, and now the world is changing. We have inclusive education, and most deaf children go to mainstream. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. And of course, we have the big event of the cochlear implant that was started to be used in the 90s in the Netherlands, and over 90% of our children, I think it's 95 now, are implanted before they are 1 year old. I couldn't find any figures for the USA, but you know, counting by the devices that have been implanted, I mean, there must be lots and lots and lots of deaf children and deaf adults who are wearing cochlear implant. Mind you, I am pro cochlear implant. I think it's fantastic that people, you know, are enabled to experience sound, but I hate how it is used functionally with deaf children because they're denied sign language, because people think that, you know, they're made hearing, and they're not. So I don't know about this, but this is my standpoint. I like CI, but I hate the policies and the politics surrounding it. So deaf culture has been blossoming the last 10, 15, 20 years. We have International Week of the Deaf, like you have, and we had a big event in Brussels only Wednesday, where more than 31 sign languages were represented, and from more than 147 countries, I think, where they were trying to come together and make a stand for the use of sign languages and for recognition of sign languages in the European Union. So that was, it was live streamed, and I think there's still, you know, possibilities to look at what happened there. We have an international film festival for for and by deaf filmmakers. And there is storytelling in NGT competitions for children aged 12. We have museum tours in NGT. There's theater groups for young children. Very occasionally, one episode of Sesame Street is translated into NGT, but actually we don't have any special TV programs for deaf children or deaf people. But then young people don't watch television anyway, you know, they go to the internet. So we don't miss it, and there's lots and lots of NGT in YouTube and Vimeo and whatever, you know, there's lots of opportunities to look at deaf news or deaf stories. I wasn't able to check my links to the internet because, you know, the room was occupied, but let us try the second one on the left. Yes, that one, thank you. See if it works. I'm so happy to have such a lovely assistant. Thank you. So this is Tony Bloom. And he is a teacher in Utrecht, but he's also an artist. He is the organizer of the International Film Festival. He has written books. I don't know what he hasn't done, you know. He's one of our most artistic deaf leaders in the Netherlands. And I'm very proud that he's my colleague. And, you know, I've learned a lot from him, and he is training young people now to become leaders in the Netherlands so that they can really stand up for their language and their deaf rights. And I just wanted to show you to him so that you can see what wonderful stuff he's making. Welcome. So what am I going to talk about? I'll give you a very brief history of the deaf education in the Netherlands. Inclusion in mainstream education, which we call tailored education. I will explain later. And then, related to that, I will talk about teacher and interpreter training in the Netherlands and how that is related to the deaf community and to deaf education. And in that, of course, the role of sign language and bimodal bilingualism. And throughout, I will try to bridge the gap between theory in academia, in the universities, and professional universities that we have, and the practice of teaching and labor and private lives of deaf people. Thank you. So this is the Netherlands, and the first deaf school was established in Groningen, right up, yes, right north, big red spot. In 1790, so that's quite old. And actually that was begun by someone who had been to Paris, to l'Abbé de l'Épée, well-known figure in deaf history, where he was so smitten by the use of sign language that he learned French sign language and took that to Groningen. So the Groningen variety of sign language of the Netherlands is closely related to old French sign language. It has changed since, of course. So other schools followed. We have five residential schools. Three of them were with the boarding facilities. And signing was used in different degrees by deaf teachers up to 1880. You know, there was a lot of sign language going on. There were deaf teachers, they were teaching in sign language. But of course in 1880, the famous conference in Milan, and that was all. Within a couple of years, there were no more deaf teachers and no more sign languages in the school, except, of course, amongst the children, because they kept using it and they taught it to the next generations. So the oral era up to 1980, there was no or little signing allowed. So 100 years of no signing. And then total communication came from the States to Scandinavia to the Netherlands. And then parents said, okay, this signing, that might work, you know. And then in the end, it didn't yield that much more academic success for their children. And then they started to insist that sign language would be used in the schools. So around the mid-90s, bilingual education started in the Netherlands. But at the same time, in 1995, that we had the first official sign language classes, the first children were implanted with cochlear implants. So we had like a parallel development, you know, on the one way, granting deaf children and people the right to use sign language, also in schools and in education, but at the same time, this medical development, technical development, that enabled deaf children to hear much more than ever before. So since 2002, children have been given cochlear implants even before 1 o'clock. And in Belgium, they even implant children at the age of 4 months. We are not, that is not allowed in the Netherlands, but in Belgium, they are very, very pro CI. So in 2014, yes, you're hearing it right, 2014, that is when we started in the Netherlands with inclusive education. You know, you've had this much longer in your country, but we are backward in Holland in that respect. You know, disability studies and thinking about how we view people with disabilities and how we should support them in leading a full life and participating fully is only just begun in the Netherlands. And this tailored education that we call it is where most deaf children with CI attend mainstream school. I will explain a little bit more about tailored education later. Don't be scared. This is the Dutch the Dutch education system. But like you, we have preschool, and then, you know, children go to school when they're 4 to 6, and it's more like systematized and it's structured. But they don't have to go to school until they're 5. So it's obligatory schooling from age 5. And then in 6th grade, they start learning to read and write up to when they're 12 years old, which is our grade 8. But then there's a big difference with state, because above the green bar, you see 3 pillars, as you might say. So at the age of 12, we make our children choose what direction they want to go to. And that is based on the impression of the teacher, but also on an exam, one exam, one day, which will enable them to go either to the highest form of secondary education, which is on the left, which is called VWO, or the middle one, which is sort of preparing for professional education, or the right one, which is pre-vocational training, and which is actually not that good. You know, the quality of that education is not that good. But 65% of the children go there. And let me tell you, most deaf children go there because, you know, they're not given enough opportunities to show their intelligence or go to the higher forms. So there's been a lot of critique on that in the Netherlands, that we shouldn't make children choose at 12. We should wait until they know a little bit more about their talents and have them choose at 16, what you do here after high school, right? So I'll come back to this system. You can forget about it. It's just that it's different from the USA, and that has quite an impact on the professional decisions that children make, or their parents, perhaps. So before we had tailored education, and remember, that only came in 2014, we had 4 pillars of special education. We had 4 clusters, we called them. Cluster 1 was for blind children. Cluster 2 was for deaf and hard of hearing children, or children with, as they call it, communicative handicaps. I hate the wording, but I'm sorry, that's what they call it in the Ministry of Education. Cluster 3 was education for physically, mentally, and multi-handicapped pupils, and for chronically sick children. So if you have a disease that, you know, makes that you have to stay in a hospital like for a long period, you are in that same group of children who are physically, mentally, or multi-handicapped pupils. You know, so children get like a, you know, like a sticker when they're like 4, what type of child you are. You know, very, very prescriptive and very, and they carry that around, you know, their whole life. I used to have this sticker, even if they lose it when they grow. And then we have cluster 4 for children with behavioral problems. So this was the system. They were separate. They were not together with the other children. So remember then we had this separate system, and then we got in 1998, we started to use bilingual education. There were several people involved, and the main thing was that we not only wanted bilingual education, no, we wanted NGT to be recognized as an official language in the Netherlands, so that the people could have, you know, use their rights and demand that sign language interpreting was provided, etc., etc. Not as a favor, as it is now, but as their right. So there were three big projects. One was to standardize the basic vocabulary for primary school. Second was a description of the grammar of sign language of the Netherlands. And the third was curriculum development for NGT and deaf culture. So I was going to show you very nice internet, but I think we'll leave it because it takes so much time. Perhaps I can show you later if we have time enough. So this basic lexicon that was to be used in education was made by the Dutch Science Center in collaboration with the deaf community. And they have a very nice website, as you can see. And there's an online sign dictionary where you can click on, and if you click on it, then you see this. You can type in a Dutch word, and then the sign will pop up. And on the yellow, on the right-hand side, you can usually see a sentence signed, so that you can see the sign used in context. And there's even some handshape information and the place where the sign is made. This is open for everyone, and you can also get like subscribe to it, and then you have access to their full database. And they're about they claim there are about 20,000 signs in their database. I think they're a little bit less, but I mean that can be discussed. What is that lexeme? What is one sign? You know, if I do I give you and you give me, is that two signs or one sign? Okay, so those discussions are going on. So the second project was a grammar of NGT, and in order to do that, they organized a consortium, you might say, of different experts who was going to provide advice and supervise the development of NGT materials. But of course, if you have bilingual education, you need bilingual materials, right? It shouldn't be all in Dutch, it shouldn't be all in NGT, it should be offered in both languages. The two pictures I show here is actually, those are screenshots from a survey taken amongst young children, how they feel about learning to write Dutch. So these are deaf children who can sign, and then, you know, so we wanted them to be involved so that they could point out what they find difficult or what they found easy, so that we could improve our materials. So they developed different books and, you might say, mini curricula for babies, for preschool children, for primary school, etc., etc. And since 2010, the Dutch government made, you might say, frameworks of reference for language, Dutch, and for numeracy, but also for other subjects in primary school. So that sort of the Dutch curriculum became standardized for all children, so that all had to reach the same target levels. And we sort of, you know, fitted our bilingual curriculum to that. So it needed to be adapted in 2010, and it has been adapted. And it's working pretty good for those children who get bilingual education. So there's a lot of reading support, of course, for deaf children, because we all know that, you know, learning to read and write is very hard for deaf people. They have to learn in their second language, and if, you know, your acquisition of that language is not very good, then learning to read and write it is even more hard. So these are just examples of how the books look like. They're very happy with bright colors. And on the left picture, you can see the scales, and you see there's for the quick children, you know, who don't need many in between steps, they can get to their target in two steps, or in three, or in five steps, depending on the speed of the child and the need of the child to learn. They can adjust their, they can make their own pace. So I think that that was good. That was quite an improvement. And the third project was, because so many children are not in a deaf environment, we need to teach them or bring them into contact with deaf culture. So they developed a sort of a package, a cultural education and identity for deaf and hard of hearing children. We call it KIDS. It's spelled with a C, but we pronounce it as KIDS. And there are six basic themes so that children can at least talk with their hearing classmates in the mainstream school about citizenship, about communication, about history, about identity issues, tools and techniques, because many deaf children don't even know what are the possibilities of the technology, you know, to assist them, and arts, sports, culture, and free time. And it's been quite successful because if there's, you know, most deaf children are isolated in a class, they're by themselves, they're the only deaf child in a class, and then they all talk about languages, about their home languages, and about their history of their families. And that way the deaf child is not singled out as, you know, being special, because all children are special, you know, and it's just his or her story, just like the other stories of the children, but they are made aware at the same time of their deaf history and of sign language and of if you're different, how you are different, because we are all different, right? So what is special about deafness, or is it not special at all? It's just deafness. So these three projects were realized. And then in 2014, we had tailored education. Actually, we should have done inclusive education, right? All children go to school, like what they're doing in Finland, for instance. Children just go to school when they're four. Perhaps they have preschool, but they go to primary school at four. And then the teachers and the parents and other specialists, perhaps, look at what does this child need to learn, right? And they optimize the environment of their child so that this particular child gets what it needs to learn. Doesn't matter if you're deaf or blind or short or dyslexic or you have an autistic form, doesn't matter, you know, because they look at the child and they provide what that child needs. We didn't do that because that costs a lot of money. So they invented something else in the Netherlands, and they call it tailored education. So children still at four get this, you know, this stamp, you know, like you are deaf or you're blind or you're in a wheelchair or you're short or you're fat or your behavior is terrible, whatever. You know, you get this etiquette, this I don't know, label, you might say. You get a label, and you carry that label around. So you have this label, and then there's a we don't know what we're doing, because the teachers they got very, very little preparation to have all these special education children come into their mainstream classroom, and you know, so they said, what do I do with this child? You know, I'm no expert. What do I do? And there's no money to get the experts in again, so we have absolutely no idea. The teachers are very negative about it. It just was, you know, pushed through by the government, and well, it's only 2 years, but. So going back to this label that children get, so who decides what support a child gets? We have this very complicated system that parents have to walk through to decide if their child is special, in what way it is special, does it get any extra facilities or not, and if so, which ones? And, you know, in the old days, they got some money and they decided together with the teacher what the child needed, no more. So it's very complicated. There are even now, you know, new businesses, you know, emerging who say, okay, we can help you, parent. We can help you do this. You know, it costs a little money, but, you know, so, you know, it's marketing and it's not a very good system, I think. So we don't know yet. Remember that in 2002, the first children with a cochlear implant before 1 year happen. These children are now around 14 and just going into secondary education. And research has shown that the facilities for interpreters, for instance, are not sufficient yet. Their reading and writing skills are not up to par, so they get into trouble. They can't go to the education they want to go. And the parents are not involved enough because they don't know, because these bureaus are now helping them to do all the, you know, so they don't know about the finer points what their child needs. So some research said that the reading comprehension in 2005, that's just, you know, 10 years ago, it was shockingly low. It was still at, you know, age 9 for children. You know, you can't go to secondary school if your reading levels are comparable to age 9. And in 2011, there was another big project started, but still the results are not known. So we suspect it hasn't improved very much, and there's sort of, you know, stalling with publishing the results. And we know that from social and emotional development that good language development alone is no guarantee for good social and emotional development in children with a cochlear implant. You know, they need support, they need to be able to get friends and to be young and you know, be up to no good. And I don't know what children need, you know, what children need, yeah. So the future of these kids is very unclear, and with that also the future and the role of sign language and interpreters is very unclear. So that brings me to my next topic, but perhaps there are questions for clarifications or someone who has an urge to say something.
Actually, can y'all see me okay? My question for you is, this is very similar and very actually parallel to the experience in the US. We do have the same issues where we are still struggling to bring deaf teachers back into deaf education. We are still struggling to bring enough interpreters into mainstream scenarios and so forth. Our settings. So even though with the smaller countries and the smaller populations, it seems the story really kind of is the same. I think the only big difference is that here in the United States, we don't have a comprehensive, unified education strategy here in the country. Most of our states, it's state by state that determines the education for deaf children. So the Department for Education at the federal level doesn't really decide. They would provide resources and maybe guidance and so forth, but it's the actual states and the local school districts that tend to make more of the decisions. So I think that's an interesting point that it's different in your country, as I was similar in your country, that the issues are the same, but the decision making for deaf education still is different, but we get the same results anyway. Yeah. Like, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, we only have 17 million people. That's larger than New York, I think. You know, so it's I can imagine that it needs to be. Like per se, because it's the whole of America is just a bit, probably. I don't know, we're very much struggling with it, and we're not there yet. But at the same time, you know, there are now parents who say, I want bilingual education for my deaf child, and I don't want him to be in a separate school. I want him to be together with other children. And there are many deaf parents who have hearing children who say, I want my hearing child to be in a signing environment in school. So we are now actually trying to find funding for a project that we are setting up to go to a regular daycare center where they are using baby signs. You know about baby signs?
Yes.
Hearing parents using sign language or signs with hearing children. And so they are already using baby signs in the care center, and now we are trying to persuade them to hire a deaf teacher who will use sign language in the classroom. So all children, deaf, hard of hearing, CODAs, and hearing children will get bilingual education in Dutch and in sign language of the Netherlands. And we have found a school that is willing to do that. We are just now trying to get the organization to accept it, and we are trying to find money, and then we might start in January with a pilot group. This is actually framed on the example in Hong Kong, where they are having co-enrollment classes, which are very successful. So we're trying to copy that and adapt it to the Dutch system, of course, but that's still that whole bilingual approach.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to clarify what you said, that in that school where they're trying to integrate the deaf teacher, all of the children in school would have the hearing teacher and the deaf teacher?
Well, if we have one class to begin with, he would be happy.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, normal children from the neighborhood, normal, children who would normally go to that school, but then added a more concentration of deaf and co-deaf children who are skilled in sign language. And then, you have to have, how do you say that, body mass? Mass? You have to
critical
have
mass.
Critical mass.
Critical mass, yeah, thank you. Critical mass of at least, like if you have 20 children, you need at least six signing children to have there. But Hong Kong did it, and we're going to do it. It may take 2 years, but we're going to do that. So, next topic. Oh,
another question.
In the United States, we also find reading print of the spoken language, deaf children are behind their hearing peers unless they've been raised signing all along, in which case we don't see that disparity. Is that also true in the Netherlands?
Yeah, true, sure. As long as you have a good first language, you can learn any other language, you know. Perhaps a little bit more effort, but yeah, sure. We have deaf children of deaf parents who are, you know, great, who are gone to university, who know English, who know some French, and you know, this generation is now in their late 20s, early 30s, and we call them the golden generation, because they're now those people who in the 90s had bilingual education in the primary school. And they're doing wonderfully well. You know, they're marrying deaf people from Norway and from Bolivia and from Brazil. They're everywhere. And they're doing pretty good. They have high degrees or not. You know, some of them have no high degrees. You don't necessarily have to have a high degree. But the potential is at least, and the choice is given to them. And then, so we have this rise in education of this bilingual. And then in 95, of course, TI came there, and then it now is going down again. Mm-hmm. So, you have a question?
I'm wondering, about parent involvement. I know that getting parents involved with their children as they're learning and so forth, the children do tend to do better if the parents are involved than if they're not. Is that the same in the Netherlands?
Yeah, that's true everywhere. Parents are so important in a child's life, and if the expectations are high, and you know, there are people in Holland who moved to Groningen, you know, this place in the north, because that's like a bastion of deaf culture. It's very bilingual school still. And for their children to have a deaf education. Hearing parents, you know, deaf parents too. And there are parents who are advised by cochlear implant doctors who say, better not sign, you know, better speak. And so we have both, you know, the whole continuum is there, same as everywhere. But the medical people are winning, we feel. You know, we really have to find. I've been in deaf, you know, the deaf field since 86, you know, that's 30 years. It's just been one big war and struggle to, you know, and it hasn't changed that much. We're back to basics now. Convincing people that sign language is good. But, you know, sign language is sexy now. People are interested in sign language. They're not interested in deaf people, but they are, you know, hearing people are interested in sign language. So that's good, it's opening up. the way into the deaf community, and it's a good step now, and it's everywhere now, on internet, on television, you know, we have wonderful Niall, of course, who's been such an ambassador for deaf people everywhere, you know, people adore him in the Netherlands, you know, young girls are running around with a picture in him, all in love with him. Okay, so back to this education system that we have, please. I just want to point out that, you know, there are like two ways of looking at this, that in the university, the academic universities, there's a lot of sign language research in the Netherlands. At the University of Amsterdam, in Nijmegen, and in Leiden University, we have different groups of people who are, you know, looking at phonology or at syntax and are describing the language in projects or in as because they have tenure. But of course, because the two schools had needed to be catered, which is in the middle column, and that's in where I work in Utrecht, where we train in the different departments. We train special educational needs teachers, NGT teachers, you know, so language teachers and sign language interpreters. So do them all. Okay, thank you. No, one back. Yeah. So we have an academy for primary education. There is an institute for secondary education, and there's the Institute for Sign Language and Deaf Studies, where we train teachers to become language teachers in NGT or interpreters, and we have a master program for special educational needs. Now, if you are a regular teacher that, you know, for regular education, mainstream education, some of them come to our master program because they want a specialization for hearing impairment, as it is called now. We are in the process of changing it, but end of next month, we have an accreditation process, you know, where we are checked if we meet all the requirements for higher education quality. And once we have that, then we're going to change everything because, you know, we want to change the name and we want to change the content. So if you had NGT interpreter or language training, you can take a master and become a first degree language teacher of NGT. So these are the people who actually teach in the universities, who teach in secondary education, and who teach parents. And the bachelors are usually, you know, for people who want to just a little bit of sign language for fun and for conversation, and they don't actually teach deaf children, of course, because you have to have native role models there. So this is the whole curriculum. You don't need to look at all of it, the whole curriculum for language training. But if you just see that 27% of the whole 4 years is dedicated to learning sign language. But we also have one tiny module on sign-supported Dutch, because there are a lot of late learners of sign language, deaf late learners, who insist on having a sign-supported speech interpreter. So we teach them the basics, but we all know that you don't become fluent in sign-supported speech unless you are fluent in the two languages that you are combining. So they find it very hard because after 4 years, you're not that fluent yet. You know, you're at the end, the upper level of intermediate, but you're not mastering yet. And so they find it very difficult, but the field insists that we take it in and we have to do it. I want it out. It should be like post, you know, like after 6 or 7 years, okay, you can try, but not after 4. But come on. Next one. So the same for the interpreter education. We have 31% of the time dedicated to teaching NGT. And even after 4 years and all this time and the intensity of the courses, we still do not have the highest levels in sign language acquisition for the hearing learners, you know. There's a question?
JC says, I'm sorry. So I used to be a teacher myself, and my first question is, why are they combining the research? Why don't we separate the two?
What do you mean, combining the research?
Well, it says here that deaf studies includes research and instruction. Are you talking about methodology for deaf instruction, or?
Well, both pedagogy and in Holland, it is now obligatory in the professional training and the academic training that all people get practice how to do research. I will come back to this later. I will explain a little bit more.
Okay, I'm just surprised that they're lumped together with the research.
Well, you know, education is research. You can't separate it. If you want to be, education is research. If you want to be a good professional, you're constantly striving to improve your practice. And you cannot improve your practice in a structured way unless you do it in a research. You know, there's research and research. I'll come back to this later. I hope to be able to explain it to you. Okay, practice research. It's here already. I thought it was later. It's the ICT because I can't see my notes. I can't read it. So practice research, what is practice research? It's actually a cycle that you observe a problem or you want to improve something. And then what do? Right? You have to do research, you read up on it, you get all the knowledge there is, and on the basis of that you design an intervention or you design a research project. You really go into it, you look at the results, for instance, of your intervention, and then if the results are good, you have to implement it again in your practice. And then again, you have to test whether or not the implementation in your practice is working. So there's a whole research cycle in the improvement and the innovation of your practice. And we feel that, especially in the field of deaf studies, you know, changes are huge and changes are fast. So we need to prepare our teachers and our interpreters to be able to deal with that. That they have like ingrained a certain, I don't know how to pronounce it, systematicity?
Systematicity, is that
the
one?
That's it.
That?
Say it again.
Systematicity.
Thank you very much. I had to pronounce it. So it's sort of, then they get used in their practice. If they see a child, they say, it's not going good with that child. You know, I have to do something, but why? Why? And then they have to find the source of the problem in the child, in the reading or in their language or whatever. And of course they can fall back on speech and language experts. But teachers don't always have the time, and it's often a tiny problem. But even for tiny problems, you have to know how to approach it, and how to solve it, and how to work it in your program. And that's why we teach them research. It's not like they get heavy, heavy statistics or anything. It's just that they need to know this cycle of research in order to improve their practice. So that's why our research is embedded into our courses, so that while they are learning about sign language didactics, or learning about interpreting strategies, that they know, my colleague is using this strategy, but it's not working. Why is it not working? They can talk about it with each other and perhaps do a little research in a good way. So not only do we have that, we also have course-independent assessment. So if a student thinks that he's ready to take a certain, you might say, level exam for sign language, then he can ask advice from his teacher, and the teacher says, yes, I think you're ready, go take the exam. So it's not like after the end of 14 weeks you get that exam. No, you can postpone it, or you can take it early if you're a fast learner. So that seemed to give the students a lot of confidence that they were in control of their own learning process. And we all know that if you're in control of your own learning process, you learn better and you learn faster and deeper. So it's first steps towards a new way of approaching learning and teaching. Then we have Lexico for Whore, as we call it. It's actually a vocabulary test for self-assessment. We all know in sign language and other languages, you know, learning vocabulary, it's a problem, you know, that students don't repeat enough, they forget signs, you know, when you're in the second course, you forget the signs of the first course. So the course must be really well designed. But usually it's a problem that the vocabulary doesn't stick. So we make them practice them, and this is fun, you know, they get little rewards when they do it right, and they can continue over the 4 years. All our vocabulary is in it. At least the vocabulary that we offer, they learn more, of course, when they go out in the deaf community. And we have the last line, Provisto, which is video feedback. But I'm sure you have that here too in the States. So I'll just show you a little picture where the student submits a signed assignment or a little clip that he has made, and then the teacher can provide feedback either in written Dutch or in sign language of the Netherlands. And in the lower two pictures, you see on the left is the student and on the right is the teacher. So the student sees his or her own mistakes or her own very well phrased sign language production, and at the same time sees the feedback of the teacher. And that has proven to be very effective, but time consuming. So a lot of teachers use it not enough because it's so time consuming, and we only have, well, time is a problem in education, as you all know from. So all these changes that we had was linked to the coming of the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages. Actually, it defined language levels. In 2001, it was published. And there were six levels, A1, novice, to C2, native-like speaker. And these were made for spoken languages. And in 2008, there was a Dutch, let me see, yes, please, next. No, sorry, I was too quick. In 2008, a Dutch version was made by the Dutch Language Institute, as we call it. And then in 2009, we thought, okay, we can use this for establishing sign language levels. Because before that, the only way to assess people was, what course did you take? Ah, that course? Who was your teacher? Okay, probably this level. That's not a very scientific way to establish a language level in professionals who need it for their job, teachers or interpreters. So we needed an independent framework where we could judge at what level, language level, second language learners were, and we used this for that. So in our teacher and interpreter course, we have 4 years. And all the NGT courses are aligned to these language levels of the CEPR. This is the sign for CEPR, by the way. I don't know if you use that. This is the sign for CEPR. Okay. Just bottom mentioned. You can see it on the left, in the left corner. So we have formative assessments during the courses. Formative assessment is assessment that helps the student to learn. It's not necessarily a test like that it's graded, you know, it's just feedback and helpful to the learner. And summative assessments via a Dutch adaptation of this sign language proficiency interview. You all know about this interview, the ASL PI. That is used in North America, actually, in Canada and in America, to assess ASL skills of people who use it. And we, together with Jeff Poor from Rochester, we adapted the ASL framework of the SLPI to a Dutch framework that fit our language and our culture. It's a 20-minute interview, and it covers the topics family, work, and leisure, and hobbies. And it's very effective. So all these developments in the Netherlands right? We have tailored education. The majority of deaf children go to mainstream schools, are not in a deaf environment anymore. Some children never see sign language. 90% of these children have cochlear implants around 1 year or earlier. And the language input of these children is focused on spoken Dutch. And sometimes, if it's necessary, NGT is offered. But mainly it is sign-supported Dutch, and I explained to you that's why we have to put it in our curriculum. But, as I said before, we all know how difficult it is to sign and speak at the same time. So we did, a long time ago, we started that research on code switching between NGT and Dutch. How much longer do I have? Where's my hold it? Sorry?
Keep going, you're fine.
Okay. So we have done research, and I have done research, on code blending in deaf and hearing children of deaf parents. Do you all know what code blending is? Sort of? Okay. I'm going to tell you. Code blending. In bimodal bilinguals. So, what is a bimodal bilingual? That is a child that has grown up with a sign language and a spoken language at the same time. Might be a deaf child, might be a hearing child, might be a hard hearing child, doesn't matter. These children get two languages as a first language. And we all know that signs and words can be co-articulated in different forms, because the nature of the blending depends on the fluency, in our case, Dutch and NGT, or in your case, English and ASL. And it depends on the conversational partner, subject of conversation, the setting, interpreters. That is true for all language mixing. You know, and all, even in monolingual conversation, the way you use your language is, and the choice of words or the choice of signs, the level of formality, do you know this person or not, it all influences how you speak or how you sign. So I hope this works. I have two examples of NGT and bimodal use. On the left, you see a deaf girl. She's 6 years old and with her deaf mother. And they are talking about her birthday, which had been that week. And she had gotten, I don't know, 3 Barbie dolls, I think. So they're talking about the presents that she got and about which Barbie dolls she got from who. On the right is a hearing boy with his deaf mother. And he's also using, you know, signs and words at the same time, but he's using his voice. And he's talking about a mouse that he found dead, you know, and he picked it up. I don't know what he did with it, but his mother's looking pretty disgusted. And, you know, they use vocalized words and signs together. It's both, you know, a mixture of signs and words, but it looks really different. So I hope they work. First, the left one, please. No. Go back. And then click on the film. Okay, they're on my seat.
Oh.
what she vocalizes there is the name Jeroen, but the rest was, yeah, there was some vocalizations, but she's using sign language, but then she vocalizes with the, you know, the name. And the other one? So, you know, they sort of covered a whole range of possibilities that you're using Dutch with some signs, or you're using signs with some words, right? That is the continuum that we're talking about. I followed these children for 7 years, so I got, like, you know, videotapes all over the place and from all these different faces. So, we see these different forms of code blending in deaf families. You know, they are really very proficient in mixing. You know, depending on their conversational partner, they go more to the sign side, or they go more to the speaking side. Well, you all know that, and many people do that. And there's been a lot of research in the USA and in Holland and in Brazil, and now in Finland as well. Where people are looking at this phenomenon, because, you know, these are really skilled signers and speakers, and they seem to do it effortlessly, you know, this blending. So how come sign-supported Dutch or sign-supported English is not working as an input model for deaf children to learn a first language? Because that's what people say, you know, we make the spoken language visible, we can just insert some signs and then they will get the meaning, and, you know, this is good enough for these children with a cochlear implant. We can just use some sign-supported spoken language. But it's not the same, you know. What these people are doing is really skilled merging of two languages, which is not the same as I can speak, you know, and sign at the same time. I mean, it's completely different. So we do this research to convince people that sign-supported speech is not good as input for first language acquisition. And we have demonstrated it, but, well, still, it's happening all the time. So is it actually possible to use two languages at the same time? You know, it's not possible to use spoken Spanish and spoken English at the same time. But you can mix them, you can take chunks from the one language and from the other language, and then, you know, sort of put them together in one sentence. Bilingual people do that all the time, you know, they code switch all the time. But how is that with sign language and spoken language? So there's either you're using only spoken language, so no hands, blah, 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 blah. That's Dutch. Or it's completely sign language. No mouth, no, only hands and face and body. Or you have all the different possibilities in between. It can be Dutch-based. You know, it's a completely grammatical Dutch sentence and there's some little signs inserted. Or it can be NGT-based or ASL-based. You know, completely structured of ASL or NGT with some words inserted. Or it can be a full code blend. So the whole, you know, all the words are also signed, or all the signs are also spoken. Or you can have a mixed blend. So you take a little bit of the one language, you take a little bit of the other, and you make what? Is it a third language? You know, is it code switching? What is it? We don't really know yet. So these are some examples of these four possibilities that you have. A Dutch-based code blend, where there's one sign, fall, and you say, that doll will fall. That doll will fall. There's only one sign at the end. Or there's a sign sentence, when there's an index, he, code blue, and you only say blue, blue. I don't know. What about blue again, Melanie? Sorry. I'm mixing my NGT, my ASL very terribly, I find it. Okay. So be it. Or there's a full code blend. These are usually very short sentences, you know, phrases that are sort of, you know, in your mind as a whole. So if you want to say, I will fetch the book, you would say, I won't use my voice necessarily, but I'm still saying, book, fetch. But book fetch, you know, it's not Dutch, because in Dutch you would say, I will fetch the book, or shortened, but it does look like a assigned construction that's possible. So it's a construction, a grammatical construction that's possible both in Dutch and in sign language. But what is it? I can't determine it, you know, it's a mixture. And this, the fourth one, is the most important, because the fourth one is the most important and the most interesting, because there we actually see a mixture of the systems, so the grammars. This utterance was signed when the mother and one of the children were talking about, say, having a barbecue and baking a fish on a fire, open fire, they were camping. So she signed, I will come back.
Thank you.
Then, hard enough. That's what she signed, right? And she said, then, when, enough. So, you know, the when it's hard enough was expressed in both languages. This is hard, that the fish was now done, you know, hard, done. But she said when. So what is that? Is that, you know, it is two grammars mixed. And these are really not that often. They don't occur that often, like up to 10% of the time. The code blends have these characteristics. So the interaction now with deaf children of hearing parents, we see a lot of influence of cochlear implants, more reliant on spoken language. There's a lot of influence of modality, you know, the possibilities of code blend give us that. And it's all dependent on the advice from professionals. What advice do the professionals give to the parents? And there's a lot of research done in Belgium by, I won't say the names, by people here on the sheet, where we find a direct influence of the way professionals talk to parents, whether or not they choose for spoken language or choose for sign language. It's the framing and the way it is told that will help people decide. So final words, I'm sorry, I've been a bit long, I think. The deaf community in the Netherlands and in the USA, are they withering because there are fewer L1 children who use sign language as a first language, but at the same time they're thriving because sign language is sexy and so many people are learning it. And there are many subgroups and hearing parents of deaf children, but also deaf parents of children who are, you know, taking a stand now for sign language. So we don't know where we're going. Are we going to sign language? Are we going to not sign language? We don't know. Education, you know, the language and the educational policies, sign language versus spoken language versus sign-supported speech. In Western countries, you know, it's all cochlear implants and mainstreaming. But in developing countries, I don't know if that's political correct term here to use in America, but we still call some countries developing countries. You know, there's a lot of emerging bilingual education because they have read the literature and see that sign language is really good for deaf children as a first language, and they don't have the money for cochlear implants. So there you see, you know, and all the Western European countries are exporting their expertise to, say, Africa, helping them set up bilingual education, while it's, you know, being shut down in the Western countries. So, you know, I don't know. Professional education, special educational needs teachers and mainstream teachers and sign language teachers, that's all changing as well. And I think that where we must start now and what we really should do, and Donna Jo is wonderful with your team, how you're trying to influence all sorts of professionals, you know, about sign language, that they need education regarding deafness and deafhood and about deaf culture, because that's the only way to, in the end, influence the parents as well, and providing at least with honest information about all possibilities.
Well, thank you. So Neil's saying, are there any questions for... Let's not turn the lights off.
Hello.
Oh,
we
did that. We did that. Please put them back on.
Kyle did it by accident.
Kyle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, I came in late. So I don't know what NGT is.
It means Sign Language of the Netherlands. It's the abbreviation for SASL with an NGT, Dutch Sign Language.
So in the United States, there's obviously ASL, and then I know there's a lot of different forms of manually coded English, pidgin sign English, SEE, etc. Are there equivalent things in the Netherlands?
We've never had a strict system in the Netherlands. It was always a free system that we had. There are some remnants of old systems, but they're not actually used anymore. Some older people still use them. But nowadays, it's like a free combination of signing and speaking, and really dependent on the skills of the person using it.
Sorry, that was a question.
I was talking to them. Okay, we have a question back.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about a topic. ASL.
No, but they can't see you.
So, ASL has a lot of fingerspelling in the Netherlands.
What?
People sign and also fingerspell, and just in comparison, how do they?
Good question.
Compare?
You know, I'm fingerspelling for me. I'm fingerspelling reading in my second language. It's really hard. We don't use fingerspelling as it is used here. We use fingerspelling really only for places, you know, cities or names of people. And if you do not know a sign, then, you know, a learner might fingerspell. But deaf people don't like to fingerspell very much in the Netherlands. We mouth. You know, with us, it's like... I'm taking ASL classes now with Melanie, and I'm looking at the old videos. When you have a citation form of a sign, there's no mouthing here. You know, there's no, we would never have that. With all our citation forms, there's always a mouthing there, because it's sort of, that's how our sign language evolved. You know, taking in, that is the influence of the spoken language. A remnant is the spoken, the mouthings. But the mouthings change, you know, they're not fully expressed, the words. They're, sometimes they become signs, like shh, shh, to be present. You know, you can say shh, just without the manual. So it's, yeah, you're shh. So it's changing as fingerspelling is also changing when it's really integrated into ASL. So it's quite different, and for me, the fingerspelling, you know, every time someone is signing, I get fine, and then all of a sudden they fingerspell, and they have to switch to English, which is my second language, and I'm lost. It's really hard. Yeah. I'll get there. I'll persevere. Thank you.
For cochlear implants, Barbara's asking, in Holland, I mean in the Netherlands, I'm wondering, like here in America, are any deaf people going over there to ask them to use them less? Is there any influence of people using cochlear implants less than here? Is anybody, you know, where are they? Are they looking into whether people actually develop? You know, because I think I missed a lot of that. So.
So.
Sorry about that. Okay.
All right, so my question is, as far as cochlear implants, you said that more than 90% of the children are implanted. How do they develop their language and speech articulation? Then when they graduate, how do they develop? It seems like a lot of them, do they understand the world around them and what the teachers are trying to communicate? And maybe they don't sign as well. How does that work?
I think it's the same as here in the States. The children are followed. There's a lot of research. The thing is that some children do, you know, perfectly well. They you know, they speak and they learn how to read and write and they do well in school. But others, you know, don't do well at all. You know, the CI just doesn't work for them. And these children, of course, you know, fall way behind, because by the time people notice that, oh, it's not working so well, you know, they're 5 years old or 4 years old. And then you have missed all those precious first language years to get a good sign language or first language in their brain. And that is my main objection to cochlear implants and the way that the medical world treats it, because it's still impossible to predict the outcome of a cochlear implant. You know, some children fine, other children bad, and you can't predict it. So why take this risk of not providing them with a sign language? And the children with the cochlear implant who do get sign language, you know, they do fine. They do as good as the children with the good children with CI do. But the children with the CI who don't benefit from it as much, you know, they're still doing bad in school, and then they go back, as they say, they go back to special education, and there the level is not high. You know, special education is not really good in Holland, so you know, it's lost potential is enormous, and by the time they're like in their teens, you know, when their whole social environment changed, because when children go into puberty, you know, it's not parents and neighbors and family that is important, it's your friends. You know, that is where you learn, where you grow to become an adult. And what do teenagers do? They talk. They talk and talk and talk. Even males, you know, they talk a lot amongst themselves. And that's where you get the lingo. You know, you have different language from your parents because your parents are stupid and old-fashioned, and you have these new, you know, cool, these new signs and new meanings for signs. And but that's also happening in spoken language. And if you are like with six teenagers together and you're deaf with a cochlear implant, you're lost, you know, you cannot follow the conversation. And that's when many deaf teenagers realize, you know, oh, I'm deaf, or I'm hard of hearing. I was brought up to be hearing because I have a cochlear implant, and now it appears I'm not, you know. So they have to not only find their identity as a teenager, but also find their identity as how the world looks at them, and the world looks at them as if they're deaf. Or, you know, cochlear implant wearer. So there's a lot of problems going on in this group that was first, I can't see you, that was first implanted before their first year, starting in 2002. These kids have a lot of problems because they said, you know, they're mad at their parents. Why didn't you teach me sign language? You know, I didn't even know there was a deaf community. And now I see all these nice things on the internet. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, all right, moving off of insults for a minute, because that's a very sore issue with some of us. I'm going to move away from that topic for a second, because it's a very sore topic. But I do want to share something with you, and I think that you've noticed it as well, which is the media today. Oh my gosh, it's wonderful. I mean, I've met so many people from other countries who are coming to the United States, especially from deaf people who are coming, you know, and I meet them, especially like in Florida, who use their own sign language, you know, and we get to communicate because we gesture more than ever. And I would imagine that you, with your research, that could become meaningless because of the media. You know, with Facebook and so forth, there are so many folks now who are using sign language on Facebook, and we're sharing videos and video outlets and so forth, where people from all over the world, I think it's going to become like one, eventually one blended language. I don't know if you agree with me. In about 50 years, you don't think that we're going to
keep
these,
afraid.
You know?
Don't be afraid. People say that about English. People are worried about that for spoken languages as well. You know, English is so dominant, you know, that all the regional languages will disappear. You know, we are now having bachelor and master programs, so in the universities, they're all switching to English. So Dutch teachers teaching Dutch students in English, right? Because then you have a better chance for future jobs if your English is good. And there are many people say, oh, yeah, Dutch is going to disappear. But it never will happen, because Dutch is our language. It's our identity. So I can use as much English as I want for international communication or for my work and reading, but Dutch is my language. You know, when I have to count, you know, even when I'm speaking English, I go back to Dutch. You know, because I can't count in English, you know, my brain can't do it. And so Melanie did the same this morning, you know, she started counting in English, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then she, oh, forget it, and she went back to, you know, that's what you do. It's your basic language is you, is in you, in your body, in your brain. It will never disappear.
Okay.
What? You're saying that's your L1.
Yeah,
that's
your L1. Because it's your L1.
Absolutely.
Right. But the L1 won't.
Yeah, and it's you. You can't take the language out of the person.
Yes. I have my granddaughter with me and my grandson. I'm hard of hearing. My granddaughter has just been diagnosed in the last year. She has bilateral hearing aids. She gives me a hard time about wearing them. She won't wear them to school. But my question is that she had an opportunity to go to a school that was predominantly sign, but there were other students in there that had other learning disabilities. And then she had an opportunity to go to mainstream school. So I chose mainstream school, and in the process of getting her an IEP.
What's an IEP?
Individualized Education Program. So my question is, what do you think is the better approach? Should I put her in a totally signing school with other students that have other disabilities, or into a mainstream school and have someone come in and sign to her in the classroom?
I can't advise you on that. I would need to know your child and know you and know the circumstances and the opportunities. You know, I would never dare to presume to advise you on the basis of what you're telling me now. I know these are really tough decisions, you know, because I don't know about the quality of that signing school, and that is, of course, important as well, you know, the quality of teaching. I don't know, I can only tell people, is your child happy? When is your child happy? When it's signing, or when it's, you know, when is your child happy? And I would go for that. Ask her.
You're getting
amens
from the people.
Oh.
I'm just learning how to sign. I'm first semester.
Good for you. Good for you.
And Neil's saying, Donna Jo, you wanted to say something?
Hey, how about you?
Okay. I think that the gentleman here who said, let's push aside the discussion of cochlear implants for a moment, it was a good thing because people start to think that what we're doing is arguing cochlear implant versus sign language.
No.
And you're not.
No.
Not at all. But it's very important that people understand the benefits of sign language regardless of everything else. And two things I think really are coming out of here that I would like to underline. One is that it's like you get into your car, you're a good driver. You have a great, strong, expensive car. If you don't put your child in a seatbelt, you're a bad parent. And, you know, if you take a risk that your child is not going to get language, what? What is wrong with you? You can't do that. It's a seatbelt. Give your child that seatbelt no matter how good a driver you are and how expensive you are. You could be in a tank. Give your child that seatbelt, number one. Number two, like Bethy was saying, the child who does very well in an oral environment, when they're a teen, and everybody's telling jokes and falling in love and using language to do it. And a joke goes on behind you and you missed it. You couldn't see, you know? And all kinds of things happen, you know, that you're not part of, you know? And all along we're saying, well, that's okay. You can read. That's okay. It's not. You, as a deaf child, have as much right to the joy of being eloquent, to the joy of telling jokes, to the joy of being playful with language as anybody else. There's no reason why we have to say that it's enough for a deaf child to just get on to reading. That's ridiculous. We don't say that to hearing children. We want everybody to be able to enjoy the full extent of what language has to offer. And you know that a deaf child can do that with sign. You don't know that a deaf child can do that with speech.
Thank you. Well said.
I think we really, that might be a good note on which to segue to a wrap up for the evening. And I'm going to turn the floor over to Kyle then for that. Wow. Oh, really. I've learned so much this evening. Because also, for better or worse, in the education field and the field of deaf studies, we're always learning something from different cultures and different countries. And the differences aren't so great. It's really a universal issue. So if we look back, you know, this is a different perspective, but it's always good to hear that. On behalf of DHCC, and Swarthmore College, the Department of Linguistics, we really thank you so much, Vivi. And she says, I want to thank DHCC for inviting me to have this talk and to meet all of those folks here, to meet the deaf people here tonight. And I want to thank you, Kyle. So for the rest of the semester, she's here, and she's here until the end of the school, through the academic year. So there will be more opportunity for her to meet the Philadelphia Deaf community and more people and the diverse things we have to offer here. So please make sure we will make sure that she sees a lot of the city. Anyway, to wrap up, if anybody needs or wants CEUs, see me. And have a great evening. Drive safe. Good night.